Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boilo, your host at Epos Radio. It is October 6th, 2020. We're just within a few weeks of the United States presidential election. The title of today's show is Moving from Survival Design to Critical Design. Critical Design, Survival Design. What's that? So we have been highly engaged in this conversation for several weeks, and we'll continue it. I find that we learn a lot through dialogue, and the more dialogue, the better. To be open to the other, to be open to the other's ideas and perspective is amazing. So we've been taking an honest look at the sorts of design thinkings in our United States and the Western world. But I want to focus mostly on the United States. When you go to Europe, for example, there's the old and there's the new, and there's just some amazing architecture and some amazing design in the Western European countries, as I recollect. In the United States, there are some very beautiful design features in some governmental buildings, some community areas, and you see those more in affluent neighborhoods and affluent areas of the country. There are some. However, you'll also notice that there is design that is very ugly and non-functional. And so there's a weird hierarchy. Some design is very functional, and functional in the sense that it produces pathways for commerce. If you look at the design of a town and see how the flow of traffic will move you to spend money, that's the way it was designed. People don't think about that sort of thing so much. Some governmental offices are designed in such a way that they want to process whatever you're there for and get you out as soon as possible. That's another thing. But by and large, it's my perception that the design in the United States is highly geared towards capitalism, production, efficiency. That doesn't make it pretty, and that doesn't make it beautiful. And that doesn't mean that it's that way across the board. That means that in those dimensions of our economy that are full of money, yes, design can be both functional and beautiful. but as you quickly move down to lower socioeconomic levels, you see less beauty, less pretty, and any kind of functionality is just meant to manage people by the government in the best way they can, or the best way it can. So survival design is a very interesting term. So when we talk about design, we're not only talking about community planning, organizational planning by states, residential and business planning. We're talking about all kinds of design, how we design our living spaces. What does it look like? Is it functional? Is it pretty? Is your computer well designed? How well have you designed your workspace? And if you live in a competitive free market economy and you're not in the top tier, then all the features of beauty, quality, creativity, efficiency start to suffer. They suffer. So I think a lot of people have been white knuckling it in the United States for a while. I think maybe for the last 30 years, we've been in this free fall from post World War II, where it's harder and harder to make a living. And so you see this huge battle in politics about, you know, whether we're going to use trickle-down economics and continue to give tax breaks to the super wealthy and hope that their situation becomes better and that in turn people lower on the scale will also benefit. Or, you know, competing types of economic structure in which we have social programs that are socialist in the sense that they redistribute wealth. And that's one of the big discussions in capitalism right now, is that out of control capitalism out of control capitalism does not redistribute any accumulated or acquired wealth back down to those who are less fortunate. So you see a tightness in design. I would call it a tightness. There's not a free-flowing design in America. There's a design that is completely structured through greed, capitalism, commodification, the struggle of each person against each other person. And when you have that kind of a win-lose structure, then it is survival. And that's the way it's always been in this country, is that you would compete against others for a job, you would compete against others for a promotion or a place at a school, and that in that kind of system, all kinds of nasty competition takes place. There are people who outright cheat. There are people who fudge the rules because the game is you have to win. You have to get ahead, or you lose. There's a winner or a loser. And so people operate out of fear and anxiety because they don't want to be on the street. Most people don't want to be so-called losers. They don't want to lose at this game. And that doesn't mean they have to be the richest person in the world. It just means that in some way, they have to compete against their peer group or their industry group and do well. But it's a setup because there are winners and losers. And that doesn't mean there's necessarily anything wrong with the losers, but it means that in scarce resource economies, not everybody will be okay. And then if you apply that writ large to macro international competition, you see how war starts. Countries compete against each other for super valuable precious resources, and they're willing to fight for them. So and then if you take the situation in which people from first world countries go to third world countries to take their resources, to exploit them, extract them, pay them below market monies for them, you see how in this survival system that the third world economy is completely dependent upon the handouts of the first world corporations. And so they're surviving. They're living with, you know, very close to the margin, very close to zero. And so they're also a great example of survival design. Take a small town, and take a small town in which there are, let's say, 15% of the population, and they're, because they haven't done well in the market competition, they don't have no money, they have no income, and they need a place to live. So if they're on the street or, you know, in shelters, eventually that becomes a problem, a disease issue and a crime problem. So people say, well, let's get these people back to work. Well, there are no jobs. And there are no places to live because there's nobody wants to subsidize them. So that's a problem. So then a developer comes and says, I'm going to build a new lower income, very nice apartment building for people without means. And then they find ways to get into these apartment buildings. But the apartment buildings are survival designed. That's my point. They're designed with the least amount of creative energy. They're designed to warehouse people, actually, to get them off the street. Think about project buildings or old tenement buildings or super low-income buildings. There's nothing about living there that's fun or interesting or creative. The walls are one monotone color. You have maybe a lot of people at home. They're not working still, so they're getting money from the government, and that can lead to negative behavior, illegal behavior. But just in terms of the design, living in a very small square box is very similar to public school education, where you sit in another square box, or going to jail or going to prison. These are all examples of other square boxes that have no stimulation, and they have a seriously deleterious effect on consciousness and on mental health. So now we have mental health problems because of our design. So what I'm trying to paint for the listeners here today, for all of you guys, is that in a free market economy, it's like going to Vegas. On occasion, somebody will win big at a slot machine, and it's very exciting for the other 999 people in the casino who aren't going to win anything, and they're going to lose a lot. And it's the same in a town. We'll just say not a super small town, but not a city, just maybe a town of 100 to 250,000 people, that a lot of money gets poured into two or three parks, some governmental buildings, maybe a downtown area. But the rest of it then is dictated and designed by free market economy, which means if you have money, you can have a great place, but if you don't have any money, then you live in a box. So a lot of negative outcomes come from poor design. Mental health issues, aggressive issues, crime issues, solidarity of a family, solidarity of a neighborhood structure, because everybody is living on survival mode. It's dog eat dog. So critical design is a way, it's a method to take a look at free market survival design. It's to really delve into all of the different parameters and all of the different dimensions of the way we design our world. And we have choices in those designs. So critical design does what I'm doing in this speaking to you today. It's to bring in other elements, to think about social and political implications, implications for education, mental health, development of the social fabric, government itself, the production of creative people, production of scientists, the production of transformative thinkings that build and develop the Aristotelian good with capital G. And that just means better ways of living. There are people in some towns who cannot make it to the farmer's market because they don't have a vehicle. And because they live so far on the edge of the town, they can't make it to the farmer's market to get fresh organic vegetables. You can blame them all you want, but they really don't have an opportunity. Maybe they have three children they're taking care of, and they're living below the poverty level, and they desperately want healthy organic vegetables. So by some stroke of good fortune, maybe somebody will be able to drive them on occasion to the farmer's market. But don't think that that's easy. That's not easy. That's difficult. And then somebody has to take care of the children. Maybe the children get to go to the farmer's market and enjoy the beauty of the market like the people with money do and can. But then the problem is, how do the people who are coming from the edge of town purchase the organic vegetables? They have no money. It's a vicious cycle. But that's a design issue, in my way of thinking. You would want to make organic vegetables freely available to people of all socioeconomic levels. You'd have a better population. You'd have a happier world if everybody has access to the beautiful things, the healthy things. But we don't have it that way. If you live in a city, it's even worse, where there might not be any public transportation that's convenient for you to get out of a ghetto area, to actually pay money for public transportation, money that you don't have, to get on to walk to public transportation, and who knows how far of a walk that is, to take you to some area of town, of the city, that you want to get to, like a good store or good services for your children. But all that takes time and money, and it might be a crime-ridden area, it might be dangerous to do, so people stay home. We're seeing this with COVID-19 virus issues right now. A lot of people don't want to lose their jobs, and even if they think they're sick with COVID-19, they don't say anything. They don't say anything and they stay home because if they call up their boss and they say they're sick, it's possible they're going to lose their job. And even if they don't lose their job, they cannot afford to be out of work for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or longer. That's a design issue. It's all services and goods in a free market economy are distributed in a, let's just say in an unequal way. Well, that's the most general way to say it. And the people with the more money get their pick of the services and goods. And then when they're done with them, then whatever's left goes to the next tier down and the next tier down. And in a way, it's like the law of the jungle. It's like being in the wilderness and being a grizzly bear and fighting for turf and fighting for food sources. And I've always thought we were better than that. I always thought that there could be a more rational approach to the distribution of resources. Think like a Marxist, and you think and you understand capitalism. Then it doesn't seem like it's out of the question to to make the statement that design quality is distributed as well. You see what I'm getting at? So you can imagine that we have survival design for the people who are in the bottom tiers, and we have a different kind of design for people who are in the upper tiers, the design of their life, their hodological map. So what's also happening is that if you look at it like a distributed, well, I think they call it a Pareto distribution, but it doesn't matter what the label is. If you look at a distribution based upon socioeconomic level of money and design, you could see, or you could imagine that people on the lower levels, as we're pressing down on levels, that people's lives, their very possibilities, and their the way they imagine their future is already structuralized. That's what I'm getting at. It's already structuralized. It's structuralized at such a deep level that people start to, their perceptions start to alter. They change their perceptions, and their perceptions alter. And so we see I would call it a homogeneity and an antiseptic quality to design. So that means the further down you go on the graph, the greater the chance that the design of your life will be less beautiful, less unique, less functional, except and insofar as it's functionality that's dictated by government, like herding sheep. So that's what I'm trying to say, is people, as you suppress the level of socioeconomic status, you increase the chances for a survival design. Now, survival design is a very important concept because it's analog in game theory, strategic and tactical thinking is what? What's the game? What's the algorithm in survival design? The algorithm is that your very social life is structured as a win-lose proposition. That is survival design. That means language, customs, etiquette, structure of neighborhoods, schools, libraries, parks, stores, places of cultural development are going to be less favored in those economies. And what is going to be more favored is aggression, violence, physical strength, lack of empathy, selfishness, and all of those character traits that allow a person to survive, because that's the aim, right? The aim is survival. And that is a very, very, very different end point or end game than is critical design. Critical design has a different aim, and the aim is a win-win algorithm. So the question becomes, if you rethink all of the other major institutions in culture. If you think about what they could do, what they might do, what they ought to do, then you have a critical focus, a critical perspective, and a critical methodology from which you can create what I call deep praxis and street or practical praxis, derivative praxis. So deep praxis means that those individuals who are engaged in critical design thinking are looking at the whole structure. That's the ontological structure. What's in it? What are the relationships of what is in it? What are these relationships? What do they look like? What do they do? What does the structure do? What is the aim of the structure? And that means every bit of the structure from the ground floor up has to serve this different aim. So you can see in mediation work how difficult this can be to change people from, or to help people transform from a win-lose psychology to a win-win psychology. It's very difficult to do that because they have a perceptual framework in which they think they're fighting for scarce resources, when in reality, that's just one way of looking at it. There are other ways of looking at it. And so that mediation framework, it can be used in every transaction in life, every single one. And it can also be looked, it can be incorporated into critical design. Mediation is an element of critical design. And if you look at the mediation model, you have a structure that allows, it creates a space for critical design. And so the part of the mediator or the middle to allow that space to develop. Without that space in between or in the middle, then if you are largely dictated to by survival design, it is really super difficult to change that design from the ground up. And that's the problem that we have in a free market capitalist economy. It's so structured at a deep level that people really view generosity or giving in all contexts as almost like an afterthought. It's something they even talk about it as in giving back. Under a critical design structure, there is no giving back because you don't need to give back. In a survival design framework, you have to give back, but you would do that in a way that's not morally required. So, in fact, it's viewed as a heroic gesture. So if you look at some of the really major philanthropists in the last 50 years, the people who have, under the system, have become the ultimate ultra winners. They have billions and billions of dollars, money that they really don't need. When they start giving back that money, It's usually seen as a form of charity. So, but it's not seen as a moral obligation, if that makes any sense. It's not a moral obligation. So that kind of thinking, that so now we've involved the moral dimension in survival design. It takes a lot of work by people to step outside of this free market competition to to be generous, I guess, to give back. So in critical design, we never do that because there's no need for charity in the first place. That's what I'm getting at. That is exactly what I'm getting at. So the question is, still, how do we get from survival design to critical design? That's the problem. And I don't think there's going to be an easy answer to that problem. That doesn't mean that that problem is insoluble. Right. It does not mean that at all. So the other piece of this is that in a survival design format, the consciousness of people is geared, structured in terms of survival. So anyway, that's the problem as I see it. But let's outline a little bit more what critical design means. Critical design says that we have the ability to make change. We have the ability to have an intentional plan. We have ability to think about it critically. We have the ability to make goals and plans, strategies. So the question is, why are we not doing that? Why are we not doing that? That's the question I have. That's what I just don't understand. Why are we not doing that? Why would we not create a more beautiful world with a better design that can be enjoyed by all? That's what I'm trying to figure out. And so what I fall back on is the self and the structure of the self and how when I was younger, I used to believe that there was a radical freedom to choose. But I realized more than ever that that had a lot to do with my own makeup, my own personal history, my own aptitudes, abilities, my own way of thinking in the world. That you have to take into account that you can't. Otherwise, you're narcissistic. I mean, we have different mental structures. And now, 40 years later, I think we still have freedom to choose. But I think more or less that freedom is highly conditioned by many factors, some that are simple and some that are not so simple. So I think there's an oddity to the self-structure of people in a capitalist system. And the oddity involves a belief that I deserve what I get. And if you look at American law and how it's been set up, there's a fiction in it. It's a fiction that I ought to be able to keep whatever I make, whatever I take. And that became so valorized and heroized right, in our laws and in our culture, and that people who are really good at dominating and being aggressive and violent and taking stuff, I mean stuff, I mean everything, material, everything, they become heroized, like they're heroes. They become known as strong, powerful people who deserve to keep whatever they've violently pulled out of the earth or violently murdered. So there's a valorization of violence. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It's valorized, it's heroized. I think it is really closely tied to the erotic element, the libidinous. I think even better is the French jouissance. It's a sense of joy, bodily joy. And I think it speaks of a feeling of freedom. So it's almost like people support the idea that whatever you can get, go for it. If you break the rules and you get in trouble, oh well. But if you're really good at getting, then you should get to keep what you get. And that goes with design too. That means that if you can pay for better design, that you deserve it. It's a psychology. It's an underlying psychology. If you can't pay for it, oh well, you don't deserve it. And you have just a lot of people who live in this really crazy illusion that they're somehow blessed. If they have a lot of money, maybe their family gave them a lot of money or they got lucky somehow, that they're somehow blessed. But it doesn't stop there. The belief says, I'm blessed and I should be able to keep my blessing. I should be able to keep my blessing. But what does that say about the other guy who may not have been blessed? That's the problem. And there truly are many, many people who believe that they deserve what they've been blessed with. And a lot of them tie it to a perverted notion of God or some weird spiritual karmic explanation, and they'll say encouraging words to the person who has not been similarly blessed. They won't give them anything, nor will they help them with anything, because they're still tied to the win-lose structure, and it's a perverted form of interrelationship. And if you want to get down and dirty, all people who are thinking about critical design need to think about something that's most basic. And that is the very design of our human anthropology, our interrelational ontology, is the most fundamental design work we have to do. I finally learned this. And it's very difficult to understand. I do not believe that most people would think in these ways. I just think they just don't know. They don't know better. You have to start at the level of ontology. And I think a really good way that is happening now, a really promising pathway on this, is that the ecologists, the ecological scientists, the ecosystem theorists, philosophers, thinkers, and designers can help us all understand that really basic level. A beauty is in nature. If we took human beings off the planet right now, we would have a more beautiful earth. So nature in itself is incredibly beautiful. So the ecosystem scientists, the ecologists, they already know this. The wildlife photographers, they already know this. They're really brilliant painters and photographers of nature. They already get it. So we have it there in our human population. We have an understanding that of beauty, and a kind of beauty that also has a correlate in morality, moral dimension. That's critical design. That's critical design. You have to start from an ontological framework that utilizes the best ecosystem science available. And we wrote this in our book about transhumanism. We wrote this. One of the basic axioms is to understand better how things work altogether. That's ecosystem knowledge. We wrote it. It's an axiom. It's true. That is a part of the evolution and transformation of the human. But the person who is, with some exceptions, the person who is filthy rich doesn't understand how everything works. They don't even see it. There are people who live at this top level. They have unlimited services and goods and beauties, and it's pretty easy to be virtuous in that world, virtuous with whatever that world means to be virtuous in. They have no understanding of the ecosystem of the bird, the ecosystem of the wolf, the ecosystem of the poor person. They don't see it. That is a design flaw. So proposition is that critical design must involve critical design of the human being. This is not eugenics. It's nothing like that. It's more about rigorous dialectic, rigorous discussion, being assertive, confronting people on their disastrous belief systems. It means taking a step forward, going into the light, risking. You have to risk in order to change. In order to change the other, you have to risk yourself. No risk, no gain. That's absolutely the way it works. This is one of the great wisdoms. And that too is part of critical design. We can't do critical design unless we challenge the other, unless we challenge the system. Therefore, it's risk. So you see how we're tying in the human experience with design and with the ecosystem and with morality, social political thinking, development, government, science. And at the very bottom of it is our interrelational nature. Now we're out of time. This is Kevin Boylo at Epos Radio, wishing you all a good week. And Nazarita Goldhammer and I will be back next Tuesday on October 13th. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.